Good afternoon, all. The case for argument this afternoon is Harrison versus McBride. Mr. Martin.
May it please the court. This court should reverse the district court's decision granting habeas relief in this case because that court erroneously found that Mr. Harrison's claim of judge bias was preserved for habeas review. Moreover, the Indiana Supreme Court's decision that Mr. Harrison failed to support a claim of judge bias was not a decision that was contrary to applicable United States Supreme Court authority. Harrison did not fairly present a federal claim of judge bias to the Indiana Supreme Court. Harrison claims that this claim was raised not once but twice. But in fact, this claim was not raised to the Indiana Supreme Court in a correct procedural posture at any time. The district court's decision finds the claim fairly presented, finding that the Indiana Supreme Court could have referred back to a petition for an original action that Mr. Harrison had filed pre-trial after the trial court denied his motion for a change of judge. This is not consistent with what Baldwin v. Reese has recently held is necessary to fairly present a claim.
But isn't Baldwin really distinguishable from our situation? Because here we have the Supreme Court's own denial of Harrison's writ of mandamus, which squarely presented the issue.
It's different than Baldwin, Your Honor, in that in Baldwin there was a different lower state court that had rendered the opinion that the United States Supreme Court felt that the state Supreme Court should not have been required to consult in order to ascertain the federal character of the claim. But in this case, although the Indiana Supreme Court was the court to which the mandamus petition was presented, and that Mr. Harrison did allege that Judge Redwine had a bias against him, that was an inappropriate procedural mechanism through which to present this claim to the Indiana Supreme Court. An original action in Indiana must challenge jurisdiction. To the extent that it challenges the trial court's abuse of discretion in denying a change of judge motion, the original action rules and Indiana Supreme Court authority interpreting them has found that that claim must be raised on appeal. It has to be raised on appeal either through an interlocutory appeal or an appeal after judgment. In Indiana, an original action is a disfavored means of presenting an issue to the court, and it's clear in the case law and in the rules themselves that it will not suffice as a substitute for appeal. In this respect, it's different than federal practice under 28 U.S.C. Section 144, where a petition for mandamus must be filed to preserve a claim that a judge should have recused himself. In Indiana, it must be done on appeal, and we've offered some supplemental authority to the court to stand for that proposition. Accordingly,
yeah, but my only point was that it was a denial of its own of Harrison's writ of mandamus, and so the Indiana Supreme Court just had to consult its own opinion, and I understand that's exactly what Baldwin requires, but my question is whether it's close enough to Baldwin, given that they don't have to search out lower courts, and I think that was part of the point of that Baldwin decision.
And I agree, Your Honor, and I also acknowledge the distinction that you pointed out. In this case, though, the mandamus petition was filed under a separate cause, and my point in raising this to the court is that there was no decision on the judge claim per se. There was no opinion, and in fact, the order that denies the original action is just a rote order saying that the action is denied. And because it was an inappropriate procedural avenue through which to raise this claim, it must be presumed that the court did not even make the decision of whether the trial court abuses its discretion in that instance. An appeal would have been required to do that. I think rather the Indiana Supreme Court's denial is a reflection of the Indiana Supreme Court's finding that it was an inappropriate action under the rules that it was asserted under. Therefore, the Indiana Supreme Court could not refer back to that for its own determination of the claims or its own assessment of what was filed by Mr. Harrison. And
were
because
the, Mr. Martin, were the pleadings in the mandamus action part of the record that did go to the Supreme Court on the direct appeal?
Your Honor, I am uncertain how much of that record went to the Supreme Court on direct appeal. I know that the Indiana Supreme Court was presented with it on post-conviction review.
Well, they did call for briefing, didn't they, on the mandamus, though you're quite correct. They didn't issue an opinion. They just issued a dispositive order.
Correct, Your Honor. And with respect to the briefing, the docket and the record that is filed with the clerk of the courts in Indiana on the original action shows only the petition and the brief in support of the petition that was filed in the opening salvo by petitioner and the court's entry that the petition was denied the same day that the filing was entered.
I'm not suggesting it would suffice for a brief on direct appeal, but I just wondered whether arguments made pro and con were incorporated in that record that went eventually on direct appeal, because this is part of the pretrial efforts in this case.
Correct, Your Honor. And there is no indication in the record that the respondent filed a brief in opposition to the petition for mandamus.
You mentioned in response to the question this abuse of discretion standard, and that standard of review is fairly low, and especially when we look at our language in Wilson, which talks about abuse of discretion arguments that have little or nothing to do with constitutional safeguards. How does that low standard apply to a constitutional claim? I know there was some discussion in the briefs about that, but I want to hear more about it.
And, Your Honor, I think that in many circumstances, and the district court likened the situation to the circumstances in the Oliver case, which is discussed in the briefs, and that was with regard to a motion for continuance. And, indeed, an analysis of an abuse of discretion in many circumstances is specifically limited to what has occurred under the particular facts and circumstances and the time in the proceedings at which something has occurred and the way that the trial court reacted. However, in this instance, this abuse of discretion was alleged to have stemmed from Judge Redwine's bias, which, and in fact, the original action petition is largely just a laundry list of things that were adduced at the change of judge hearing that they claim supported the conclusion that Judge Redwine was biased. And in that posture, it's not dissimilar from the federal rules as they apply to a motion for recusal based on bias. We discussed it with respect to the, and I'm sorry if I'm mispronouncing this, TZAC case, which was decided by this court. And in that posture, a federal court also reviews for abuse of discretion. And I don't think that it could be said that the court would do so without regard to the constitutional protections that the defendant enjoys. And I just want to touch on the fact, Your Honor, that the Indiana Supreme Court's language in addressing this claim on direct appeal very closely tracked the same language that appears in Indiana's appellate rule with respect to cogent argument. We are aware of the requirement on habeas review that a state court expressly find waiver. But without respect to whether we have an independent and adequate state law ground that we can argue on habeas review, I think that the language fairly, well, actually strongly supports the conclusion that the Indiana Supreme Court indeed found and considered this claim waived But because this is a death penalty case, they went ahead and considered the facts and circumstances based on the very thin, cursory way that the claim was raised before trial, and found, after reviewing the record, that the trial court had not abused its discretion. And I think in that posture, the district court was wrong both to find that that decision wasn't entitled to deference under 28 U.S.C. 2254D, and also erred in finding that the Indiana Supreme Court was outside of the parameters of reasonable application of controlling federal precedent. And as this court struggled with what precisely is required to show judge bias on habeas review in the Bracey case, it's clear, well, this is kind of an awkward turn of the phrase, but it's clear that it's not crystal clear. That is to say, it's not precisely defined what constitutes judge bias and what doesn't in a given case. And for the district court to conclude that the Indiana Supreme Court was somehow unreasonable in reaching this conclusion is in violation of the spirit and letter of 28 U.S.C. 2254D. There were a couple of things that the district court referred to in reaching this conclusion that I believe were erroneous, and one we've already discussed, which was the focus on the abuse of discretion standard. But the other one is that the district court seemed extremely concerned with the fact that the Indiana Supreme Court had used some language regarding a showing of prejudice. And that is to say that the Indiana Supreme Court said that Mr. Harrison had failed to make a factual showing regarding an undisputed claim of prejudice. In the context in which the court encountered this claim, it was reasonable to surmise that the court may have been discussing prejudice in light of a possible fundamental error analysis. However, after consideration of one of the cases that was offered as supplemental authority by the petitioner in this case, I think it's clear that the Indiana Supreme Court's language on direct appeal with respect to prejudice pertains specifically to prejudice that would or would not have been harbored by Judge Redwine against Mr. Harrison. It's not that the Indiana Supreme Court found that Judge Redwine harbored some possible degree of bias, but that it didn't prejudice Mr. Harrison during the course of his trial in any way. Rather, the Indiana Supreme Court found that Mr. Harrison, with the evidence that he adduced at the change of judge hearing, did not show the prejudice that Judge Redwine was alleged to have harbored against him. So, and the case that was submitted, which is the Harrington case, discusses a claim in exactly the same language that the Supreme Court used in this case, stating, and I quote from that case, "In a criminal proceeding, a ruling on a change of judge motion is discretionary. On review, a clear abuse of discretion must be shown. Such abuse exists only where there is an undisputed claim of prejudice or where the judge has expressed an opinion on the merits of the controversy." Then it goes on to say the trial court denied harboring prejudice against the appellant, and talks about the prejudice that the trial court may or may not have had for the petitioner.
Well, in this situation, we have Redwine contacting ex parte Greathouse, about whom all these allegations were made, regarding Harrison's motion for a new judge. Doesn't that alone constitute possible bias? And especially when you add up all these other factors.
No, Your Honor, and the reason why is because I think that Judge Redwine, under these circumstances, just wanted to make as thorough of a record as possible on the allegation of bias.
Which, that's why he called Greathouse?
Because he wanted Greathouse to come and testify at the hearing, correct, Your Honor. And at that time, he had the conversation recorded by the court reporter. If Judge Redwine were attempting to cover something up or doctor Mr. Greathouse as a witness before he arrived to court, it seems incongruous that he would have then also had the conversation recorded by an officer of the court. And there was definitely some proactivity on the part of Judge Redwine in meeting the presentation of these hearsay statements. But the important thing is that there's no indication that Judge Redwine was going to rule unfavorably against Mr. Harrison based on these allegations that were contained in the hearsay statements for which Ms. Forsey was the declarant.
But he did a number of things. He moved up the trial date 2 months. He refused to grant a continuance when there was delayed disclosure of the DNA evidence. I mean, there were a number of things that when you look at all those things.
And in review of the entire record, I would submit to the court that this does not show bias. And that is not with any opinion offered as to what the best way to proceed under any one of these circumstances would have been. But with respect, for example, to the DNA evidence, there have been earlier hearings on whether the defendant had wanted that evidence presented to the jury. And, you know, the Indiana Supreme Court did note in its decision that it's not crystal clear from the record what Mr. Harrison, what the defense was agreeing to have entered or was willing to have admitted with respect to that DNA testing and what they weren't. But it is unequivocal that they did want some of that testing done and did want some of that evidence presented to the jury.
But, Mr. Martin, do we sometimes on this issue reach a tipping point because of cumulative matters? There are a couple things that standing alone might not seem that much, but didn't Judge Redwine in one case order the defense counsel to hand over a training manual handed over to the defense from the defense to the prosecution that they had received at a death penalty conference, and government counsel had been at the same seminar. I assume he received materials, attendant to their responsibilities. He didn't have a. I'm not sure what the exchange was all about or why it would be relevant to turn it over, but he did that. And then on the issue of the compensation for the mandamus proceeding, as I understand it, my notes reflect that he refused the compensation in responding to an inquiry from the Public Defender Commission, where he said that he found the time spent basically was not fruitful because the trial court and the Indiana Supreme Court found them to be meritless matters. Would you say, considering the unique settings of the judge's interaction in related cases prior to this case, that is the paternity suit and the other litigation, that it was let me frame this as the way I want to make sure it's, that you understand it. Do you think it was a sloppy practice to at least seek the change of judge in this case? I mean, it seems a little surprising to me that the trial judge would deny compensation for it. It does seem to bespeak his being a little upset, maybe. At counsel, and I don't know whether that would spill over into other things, but it is a little troubling to read that.
And, Your Honor, I think the record reflects that the judge was not pleased with counsel in the respect that they did not make any attempt to verify or follow up on these bare hearsay allegations. What they did was rely on statements that Ms. Forsey had, while she was naturally still living, given to police officers, and did not then go to any of the sources or subjects of those statements and try to confirm or exclude the factual accuracy of any of them. They just came and offered them. And that's what the concern is here, is that if to accept what the district court decided, one would almost have to accept that any time a criminal defendant is able to present before a trial court allegations of improper or illegal behavior, no matter how factually unsupported or unverified they are, that it creates a de facto disqualifying bias and essentially would amount to a license to judge shop.
Well, and then if it was just one factor, I could certainly see that. But there were so many factors, so many things, so many allegations that were made. And then we had the tape of the conversation that disappears and all these things that when you look at all this together, certainly you would agree the wiser course would have been for Red Wine to recuse.
Well,
the appearance of impropriety, at the very least.
I agree, Your Honor. However, I think that Judge Redwine viewed the issue precisely as I just presented it to the court, which was that he was not going to be forced to remove himself from this case, when I think that a review of the record will show that he left open the possibility of admitting evidence, particularly with respect to these statements. The defense told the court that their anticipation was that the state was going to present state-of-mind evidence regarding the victim's fear of Mr. Harrison, and that under those circumstances that they would be able to rebut that evidence with these allegations that were the basis of the change of judge motion. That did not happen, nor did Judge Redwine ever conclusively prohibit them from offering this evidence in rebuttal or other evidence in rebuttal. It just did not come to fruition. And on post-conviction review, Mr. Harrison did not show that it would have come to fruition absent Judge Redwine's rulings or the manner in which he presided over the trial. At the bottom of all this, it's simply not unreasonable for the Indiana Supreme Court to have found that Mr. Harrison did not support these allegations of judge bias and that decision was and that decision was reasonable, but the overriding point is that to the extent that there's any lack of explication in the Indiana Supreme Court's adjudication of this issue, it's due solely to Mr. Harrison's insufficient presentation of this claim, which should bar it from habeas review in the first place. Does the court have any further questions?
I guess not at this time.
All right. All right. Thank you, Your
Honor. Thank you, Mr. Martin. Ms. Longsharp.
Good afternoon. Chief Judge Flom, may it please the court.